From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Friday, February 4th. I'm Marco Werman. The protesters in Cairo dubbed today Departure Day for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak.
I think I'm here for just one reason, for the guy to get out.
Well, Mubarak continues to stay put despite growing U.S. pressure for him to go. Also, the unrest in Egypt makes many governments in the region anxious. Today, it's Sudan's turn.
I think it's got to be making the ruling regime in Sudan very nervous.
And later, a new study concludes there's a global rise in obesity.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Cairo's Tahrir Square filled again today with tens of thousands of protesters calling for the ouster of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Protesters had dubbed it Departure Day. Yet, after 11 straight days of anti-Mubarak demonstrations, the man who has ruled Egypt with an iron grip for 30 years remains in power. For how much longer is anyone's guess at this point? We'll hear more in a few minutes about U.S. efforts to arrange a quick exit for Mubarak. But first, we turn to the world's Matthew Bell in Cairo for an update on today's demonstrations.
Egyptians like this man flocked to Cairo's Tahrir Square today in huge numbers to repeat their message to President Mubarak.
I think I'm here for just one reason, for the guy to get out. That's the main issue. I think because he lost his credibility among the people, the violence that happened. There's no credibility in a cardboard president now.
He went on to say that this people power movement will ultimately succeed in putting an end to the Mubarak government.
This is a civilized unrest like the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. You remember the Orange Revolution in Ukraine when the people just sat down? After sitting down, they left.
Friday is the Muslim day of prayer, so the crowds in the square knelt down and prayed together. Demonstrators also prepared for the worst. They organized medical supplies and piled up stones, the weapon of choice during the previous 2 days of violence. Egypt's defense minister visited the square today. He urged people to go home for the sake of the country. The new vice president, Omar Suleiman, told ABC News that the army will never use force against the demonstrators. He also said the government will launch an investigation into this week's violence. None of that, however, was reassuring to Ahmed Bahat Mansour. He said President Mubarak simply must go and take the decades-old emergency laws with him.
First, he's a liar. Second, he's a criminal. He has to be sent to the court. Why didn't he cancel that military ruling? He can catch any one of us for no reason. That's what he's doing for 30 years. Why didn't he cancel this type of military rules?
The real election is right here, he said. As for the country's future, Mansour is optimistic.
I'm a green card holder. I could go to America, and till now I can go to America. And actually, by the way, I'm not against America. I'm just telling you, I can go to America, however I'm staying here, for this land, for this nation, for this country to be much better.
President Mubarak has said he wants to step down, but claimed he can't because the banned Muslim Brotherhood might seize control. That's a frightening prospect for some Egyptians, but the scene in Tahrir Square today made it less frightening for this Egyptian-American businessman.
Mr. Mubarak is using this. He's scaring us from each other. Today is the day I stood next to a guy with a long beard and felt that he's my brother. If we have a constitution, who cares who runs it? If at the end of the term we don't like who's running it, like American people, we say no. We don't want you folks. We need new people.
Another thing Mubarak has told Egyptians is that his rapid departure would be disastrous. So, according to the president, Egypt is left with two options, Mubarak or radical Islam and chaos. But this demonstrator offered up a third way.
He make us afraid of each other. He will say, me or chaos. Now we are saying, you or salvation. We need salvation.
That report from the World's Matthew Bell, who joins us on the line now from Cairo. Matthew, we heard those clear voices there at Tahrir Square opposed to President Mubarak, and elsewhere in Cairo today, there were pro-Mubarak demonstrations, but for some reason, very few of the Mubarak supporters were at Tahrir Square. Do you know why?
I think one reason, Marco, is just that there were so many anti-government demonstrators there, and maybe there was a feeling that they would be outnumbered. Of course, the anti-government demonstrators I've talked to, many of them believe that the other side was comprised largely of people that were paid off to show up and engage in the kind of street battles that we've seen for the past couple of days, and that they took their cash and went home. There's another factor. The army has done a few things to secure the perimeter of the square. They're also being more careful about who gets in and who gets out. So I think that's been a factor as well.
A leader of Egypt's main opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood, said today that the group has no plans to put forward a candidate when the next presidential election is held there. I know there's been a lot of speculation about how the Muslim Brotherhood fits into this crisis, but what is the significance of that statement today from the Brothers' leader?
The Brotherhood has been very careful about the way its role is perceived in all of this from the very beginning of these protests that started on the 25th. It has said that it wants to support the desire of the Egyptian people. So in a way, they've really hung back on the sidelines. Their members have participated in these demonstrations. Some people say more and more of the members have participated as they've grown larger. So the group says it won't put up a candidate. That doesn't mean that it won't endorse a candidate. Could be significant, of course, in a future election because the Brotherhood is an important organization here. They've got real reach into Egyptian society.
There were reports today that the U.S. is trying to negotiate a quick exit for Mubarak. Any reaction from the demonstrators you spoke with about that?
Their views about the United States are complicated and contradictory. I've heard complaints about President Obama doing too little, too late to help get rid of Mubarak. I've also heard from people, sometimes the same people, that they don't want the United States to meddle in Egypt's affairs. One guy told me, Egypt is not Iraq. We don't want the Americans to come here. So people are paying attention to what's coming out of Washington, but a news report like that, I didn't hear big reaction from it today.
The World's Matthew Bell speaking with us from Cairo. Thanks for the update, Matthew.
You're welcome, Marco.
President Obama took reporters' questions on Egypt for the first time today. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Obama again called for a meaningful transition of power in Egypt to begin now.
That transition must initiate a process that respects the universal rights of the Egyptian people and that leads to free and fair elections. Now, the details of this transition will be worked out by Egyptians, and my understanding is that some discussions have begun.
The administration is reported to have been negotiating an exit for President Mubarak. Nicholas Burns is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a former U.S. diplomat with extensive experience in the Middle East. Ambassador Burns, Mr. Obama also said today that the future of Egypt will be determined by its people. I guess some would say that could be optimistic or high pressure. Do you think the White House is leaving Egypt alone so that the Egyptians do determine their future?
Well, I think President Obama is trying to be careful because he doesn't want to give the impression that the United States means to dictate affairs in Egypt. In fact, the president said we can't because only Egyptians can decide their future. But on the other hand, the U.S. has enormous influence, and I think that the president is doing two things. He's being very clear publicly that he's on the side of reform and transition. He said again today, we need a speedy transition. He condemned the Egyptian government for what they have done in Tahrir Square against demonstrators, against protesters and against the media. But interestingly enough, he's trying to indicate here that President Mubarak has to leave, but he's doing it in such a way, I think, to try to preserve the pride of Egypt's president. He's essentially engaging in quiet diplomacy behind the scenes. The administration's obviously trying to encourage President Mubarak to leave, but they probably judge that they'll be better able to do that if they speak very quietly and not call publicly and openly for President Mubarak's ouster. I think that's probably the right strategy.
What is the end state that Washington wants to see in Egypt?
Well, the United States has enormous stakes in Egypt. It's one of our most important partners in the Middle East, and so obviously the United States wants a return to stability. And I think they've judged correctly that stability can only return if the Mubarak regime ends. if there's some kind of transition towards reform, a process where opposition leaders, religious opposition leaders, secular opposition leaders, can begin to define a new Egypt, perhaps a new constitution, leading to new elections. I don't think that after the protests of the last several weeks in Egypt and the Arab world, you can return Egypt to what it was, a dictatorship under Mubarak. The president realizes that. It seems to me from the press conference today he's trying to move things in that direction.
Very briefly, if Washington doesn't get that state, things could default to basically keeping the old regime, but with a new figurehead. What about all the rhetoric about wanting democracy in the Middle East?
I'd be very surprised. I think the administration's been clear. They want a transition. Now, that transition could be with elements, people from the Mubarak regime, but they clearly want to see a new Egypt, one that would be more representative of its people and yet retain the close relationship with the United States. That's going to be a very difficult challenge, but it's the challenge that that President Obama clearly indicated he supports today.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns is professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Egyptians here in the U.S. are following events back home closely, and opinions are divided, just as they are in Cairo. At a small church in South Florida, some supporters of Egypt's embattled President Mubarak are supporting him through prayer. They are Coptic Christians, members of an ancient Orthodox branch of Christianity and a minority group in Egypt. Javad Kalim of the Miami Herald paid them a visit.
Nadia Gerges left Egypt 15 years ago for the same reasons her countrymen are taking to the streets today. She wanted a chance at better jobs, more freedoms, and a better life. But as violent demonstrations rage in her homeland, the Coptic Christian has become a reluctant supporter of the widely disliked Mubarak. She says the secular leader has pursued Islamic extremists during his reign and has been a reliable friend to Christians.
You know, he was okay, not perfect. He was okay, but now we say, you know, he's better than we don't know what's going on after. It's a mirage for us, you know. It's something, you know, we don't know what's going on after. I wish we can let him stay forever until he die, because we are very scared from this Muslim fanatic people.
That fear of fanaticism is the main reason that Coptic Christians make up a disproportionate amount of the nearly 250,000 Egyptians now in the U.S. In Egypt, Coptic Christians are routinely denied jobs. In recent years, they have been shot at during religious ceremonies. This New Year's Day, extremists bombed a church in Alexandria, killing dozens. Gerges is part of a congregation of about 200 Coptic Christians in the Miami suburbs who have been meeting twice a day this week to pray for peace and the safety of Mubarak. Gerges and many of her fellow churchgoers fear that Islamists could take over the Egyptian government, and that could be disastrous for the country's 8 million Coptic Christians. Father Timotheus Solomon has led St. John the Baptist Church for a decade.
I believe the Islamists were behind the terrors that have happened and changing it from a peaceful protest to a riot. And that's what we're afraid of, that it will be turned into another Iran.
Coptic Christians haven't been completely absent from the rallies in Egypt calling for regime change. But the church's leadership in Egypt and abroad has avoided criticizing the president. In Egypt, the church's head, Pope Shenouda III, gave his support to Mubarak in an interview with state television this week. Safwat Iskander readily admits that Coptic Christians and Egyptians as a whole have suffered under Mubarak. And he says even if Islamists don't run Egypt, other alternatives look just as bad if Mubarak steps down.
If he let go at this point, it's going to be like a disaster for Egypt, because there is no control, no power, no government. So we pray that if it worked out to stay like for 6 months.
The Coptic Christian Church was founded in Alexandria, Egypt in AD 42. And at St. John, as he does every week, Iskander prayed that this ancient church will survive another 2,000 years.
Egypt belongs to Christ.
For The World, I'm Javed Kalim in Miami.
You can check out our complete coverage of the crisis in Egypt at theworld.org/Egypt. Coming up, a global rise in obesity on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's a quick test. Name an Afghan-American writer. Okay, there's Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novels The Kite Runner or A Thousand Splendid Sons. Any others? Well, a new anthology showcases the work of several contemporary Afghan-American writers. One Story, 30 Stories features poems, fiction, essays, and even blogging. Reporter Bruce Wallace has more.
Zohar Saeed and Sahar Muradi both left Afghanistan when they were young. So for both of them, their early impressions of Afghanistan came from their parents' stories. Muradi's father would tell her legends from the country's past, or stories about working in his father's knitting factory in Kabul. Saeed's father would illustrate his stories with photographs and postcards he'd brought with him from Afghanistan. These images were a counterpoint to the Afghanistan she saw elsewhere.
For me, it was trying to compare these postcards of movie theaters, hotels, and the city that didn't match with the rugged mountain images that I was seeing on the nightly news in the 80s with Dan Rather going into the mountains and, you know, hanging out with the Mujahideen.
Saeed says that a lot of the writing in the collection comes from an impulse to provide a sort of counterpoint, particularly after 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. She says that Afghan Americans felt a responsibility to share what they knew.
What kind of answers do we present when there are so many questions directed at us about Afghanistan, about being Afghan American, about living here? Because we were being held accountable for our identities, I think that is when we started answering, and in that answering came a lot of this writing.
The anthology's contributors include professional writers, musicians, filmmakers, academics, former ambassadors, and doctors. Much of the work deals with how families are stretched and strained by the process of relocating to the U.S. Zohar Saeed's poem, Neptune Avenue, speaks of her childhood gang of siblings and cousins in Brooklyn who find their own strangeness both alienating and exhilarating.
We'd rather dangle out every day on the fire escapes of the second floor mosque, spill the chutzpah onto the sweating concrete by opening the windows wide, then jump onto the sidewalk, align our velvet prayer mats next to parked cars, and play Imam and Ummah as passerbys gawk at the magic of our flying carpets, and at 1 5-year-old brother, serious-faced, hand over ear, singing out the call to prayer with a sugar-sweet throat.
And, of course, war is a constant presence in the collection. It's the reason families flee Afghanistan, and it's why many are now traveling back there to do humanitarian work. A poem by Sahar Muradi called Of My Mother tackles the loss of homeland. In this passage, her family is leaving Afghanistan on a bus bound for Pakistan.
I think of my little bag, my khaltagak, the pillowcase that I keep all my treasures in, apple seeds and lost buttons and little webs of lint. Your mother says she will keep it safe for when we come back from the trip with new treasures. But you have so many more things than we do, so your missing is so much bigger. It takes up all the room on our seat. It splits the vinyl, fogs the windows, and spreads to either end of the bus.
Zohar Saeed says that war has given many of the writers in the anthology a sense of guilt, an obligation to succeed because so many of their relatives weren't as fortunate as they were. She says that it also affects the style of the writing.
War, you know, of course, affects narrative, how we write, the bits and pieces, the fragmented way that some of the writers are writing here is about, you know, the fragmented way we've grown up.
For all its heaviness, the collection does have plenty of moments of wit and happiness. For Sahar Muradi, one of the joys of poring through all the work was finding other writers talking about bits of everyday life that were so familiar to her.
I was just so thrilled to read things that resonated with me. I mean, of course, all great literature does, but there's something really profound about reading a story about a mother who goes to the 99-cent store and buys the Brucci lipstick for her daughters and gives home perms and all these things that were so particular to my childhood as well.
In fact, it's everyday rituals like this, lipstick and home perms and playing with siblings in the street, that seem to make the harder stuff here bearable. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace.
Obesity is not just a problem in the U.S. Globally, people are getting fatter. New figures published today show that worldwide, the percentage of adults who are obese has approximately doubled in the past 30 years. Professor Majid Ezzati of Imperial College London led the international team of researchers that examined health data from 199 countries and territories. No big surprise that American adults were the most overweight among all high-income countries, but many less wealthy regions of the world are also seeing high rates of obesity. Which regions and why?
The countries that came up as having some of the highest levels of overweight and obesity were some of the Pacific Islands, some of the countries in North Africa and the Middle East, some of the Caribbean countries, and possibly surprising, actually, the Southern Africa region. They had some of the highest levels of obesity in the world. And as you mentioned, among the high-income countries, the United States was by far the single highest one.
I mean, a lot of people immediately turn to the spread of fast food around the world, people sitting more in front of TV. I mean, are those factors sedentary lives and processed foods?
It doesn't have to be eating a different type of food, fast food. It could be eating more of the same. But as long as it is eating more of either the same or different foods and being less active, and less activity may not be sitting in front of TV, but it may be the fact that people who were active in farming and fetching water and wood for their homes are doing less of that. Now, some of those are good things for life, but there seems to be no replacement for those activities that may be going away with urbanization and some conveniences of life.
Is some of the variation in obesity rates from country to country due to genetics? Maybe there are different ethnic groups prone to different body types. I'm just wondering, is it safe to use a single definition of obesity worldwide?
Research has at least indicated, if not shown, that genes, you know, may affect weight gain. But remember that people in these countries had the same genes 3 or 4 decades ago. So what genes cannot explain is the massive rise that has happened in any one country over 3 or 4 decades. It may tell us something about the geographical differences, but clearly there is something else happening in the background to be acting on top of these genes to increase obesity level.
Do you have any sense of what that thing happening in the background is?
Well, I mean, I think different hypotheses have been used. One of them is that it is just easier to eat these days than it was a few decades ago. A few decades ago, if you wanted a particular food, you actually had to go and make it. In many places in the world, it's actually easy to just get it and eat it. So not just the cost of it, but the convenience of eating has become more. We probably use systems of transportation and in our occupation, things that use less energy. So all of these are on top of it. But remember, we don't have to go and reverse everything that has changed to be able to reduce obesity. What we want to do at this point is not necessarily get rid of cars. That's going to be quite difficult, but to figure out what are the actions that as societies, as nations, we can take today that would lead to either curbing and ideally reversing the increase that has happened, and we should be going after those actions. It could be putting lots of taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. It could be making bike lanes that are really good and safe. Whatever they are, as possibly extreme as they may sound, they should be pursued if we believe that the health effects of this rise in obesity are large.
Fascinating research indeed. Professor Majid Ezzati is the chair in global environmental health at Imperial College London. His studies of obesity, blood pressure, and cholesterol levels worldwide have just been published online by the medical journal The Lancet. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have a lot more on this subject online. Learn how Singapore, Finland, and other countries are battling obesity. That's all at theworld.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, we hear what some of the protesters in Cairo's Tahrir Square were saying today, and later the debate in Berlin on whether to name a street after Ronald Reagan.
I have learned in politics, naming streets is one of the most, it's a very emotional thing you can do.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Tens of thousands gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo today to demand the resignation of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Earlier in the day, the army reinforced checkpoints at the entrances to the square, so people stood in line waiting to get in. Ursula Lindsay stopped to talk to some of them and sent us this report.
Ahmed and Mohammed are university students. Ahmed says they've been waiting for an hour and a half to get into the square.
I want to say history is changing. I'm Egyptian. I've lived in the U.S. I've been to Europe, all around the world. I want to feel my country's changing. And in 10 years, when I see my children studying Egyptian history, I want to say I was there. I changed this country.
Ahmed and Mohammed say the violent attacks by pro-government groups have scared away some protesters. Mohammed blames Egyptian state TV for doing that as well.
They're trying to manipulate the people's mind with the media. It's all about confusion. It's all about sticking to a regime which has been here for a lot of time and it didn't make a lot of change. And now they're saying in only this 6 months, they're going to make all things better. It's nonsense for me.
At the entrance to the square today, some Egyptians who support President Mubarak argue with anti-Mubarak protesters. Many government supporters blame the demonstrations for bringing daily life to a halt. The government has shut banks, gas stations, universities, and government offices. While shops are open, prices are rising. You've stopped the whole country. We want the country to run again, says one man. A protester responds, "Was it running before?" The protester goes on to say, "I won't leave. All I've done is said enough. You want to hit me, you want to kill me, go ahead." State Control TV has been full of references to foreign infiltrators being behind the protests. And rumors are circulating. People variously mention Iran, Hamas, the U.S., and Israel as the culprits. When the subject comes up today, a protester tells a pro-Mubarak man, "The Jews actually support Mubarak. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is going around telling the whole world he supports Mubarak." Another group argues over who could replace the president. The head of the High Constitutional Court, one protester says. The head of the court would be next in line if Mubarak, his vice president, and his Speaker of Parliament all step down. "But the president is concerned for us," one Mubarak supporter says. A protester yells back, "If Mubarak stays, our children will be slaves." The protests have been remarkable for the presence of Egyptians from all walks of life and for the presence of women. Somaya, who is 17, is here with her brother, mother, and sister.
We are waiting for it to clear a bit and we are going to enter.
And so you're not afraid today? Even though
we're not afraid. I feel very safe, actually. It's the safest place in Egypt right now. And this is what people are saying inside in the Tahrir Square. And I believe in this too, and I'm going to enter.
Many people are bringing in food and water. Karim Hosni is a doctor at a nearby hospital. He and some colleagues in white coats make their way nervously towards the entrance today. Hosni says he's been here before as a protester. Today, he says, he's going as a doctor. He's bringing sutures, gloves, local anesthetic, and other supplies for the emergency clinic set up in the square.
Just in case they need them.
Hundreds have been injured in the clashes in the past few days, and several have been killed. But the demonstrators seem determined to hold on to Liberation Square. For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
Things are also tense in Sudan. Police broke up student protests in the capital Khartoum today, and army units clashed in the southern town of Malakal, killing at least 9 people. And in Darfur, in the west of Sudan, hundreds of people are on the run after a recent surge in violence. Rebecca Hamilton is author of the new book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. She's just back from a reporting trip to Sudan and joins me in our studios in Boston. Thanks for being here. I mean, the big news out of this part of the world is Egypt this week, but it's interesting how much is actually going on in Sudan today. We'll talk more directly to Sudan in a moment, but for you, Rebecca, with Sudan right next door to Egypt, what are the implications for Sudan of Egypt, but also, you know, the other uprisings in the region?
I think it's got to be making the ruling regime in Sudan very nervous.
because they know that in many quarters they don't have the popular support of the people. There were supposedly democratic elections last year, but they were neither free nor fair. And there are many in the north of the country who don't want to see this regime stay in power.
I mean, it's a delicate time for Sudan. The country is about to split in two after southerners voted overwhelmingly last month for independence. Before the referendum, there were great fears of a return to civil war. What do you think the prospects are now?
I think the referendum went off incredibly well, successfully, peacefully, and there's no doubt that southerners have voted for independence. The question is not only the viability of a new southern state, which is starting from a position where there's a population that's 85% illiterate, where there are only 40 miles of paved roads in the entirety of the country, but also what is the viability of the new northern state? At the moment, the northern economy is in a terrible situation. It's about to lose some significant share of the oil revenues when the south splits, and how long can it sustain this population if the economy goes south?
Now, Rebecca, your new book is about Darfur and specifically the U.S. advocacy movement to stop genocide there. Before we get to that movement, what's happening in Darfur today?
The situation in Darfur today is bleak. All of the causes that led to the massacres that we saw in 2003 and 2004 that captured global attention, all those factors are still in play. The people who perpetrated those massacres are still in power. There has been no accountability. There has been no compensation. There are 2.7 million people who are still in displaced camps who can't return to the land that they were forced to flee from. And whilst the international attention has been on the south, you've seen the government ramping up again its military campaign in Darfur.
Are there people dying? Are people getting killed?
Yes, people are dying. More than mass deaths, you're seeing mass displacement because people are scared. They don't feel secure. And the situation has become so much more complex than if we had got involved properly early on, because now, in addition to what are seen as the victim groups, the non-Arab groups in Darfur, the Arab groups themselves that were manipulated by the government to conduct some of these atrocities back in 2003, 2004, also feel like they're disenfranchised, they're turning against each other and against the government.
Well, that leads us directly to your book and what it's about. You've done some incredibly extensive reporting and also some soul-searching about what activists were able to achieve. You were yourself an activist for Darfur in the beginning. The movement on the surface seems to be a force for good, the movement to get around this genocide in Darfur from the United States. But how much did it complicate the reaction to the genocide, do you think?
Hugely complicated the policy response. There are dynamics that come with a mass outcry. They demand strong rhetoric from whoever they're targeting, which was in this case the U.S. government, and they push them to come out with rhetoric that consistently said Darfur is a genocide, very strong language. That could have been useful if they had the policy options to back that up. But the U.S. government was in many ways the worst placed government at this particular period in history.
And
geopolitically speaking, after the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, U.S. credibility was at an all-time low to be the one that was speaking out on human rights abuses. And so I think the theory of the movement had been coming out of a kind of 20th century analysis. If the U.S. gets out there in front and speaks on human rights, then the world will follow. In actual fact, the reverse happened when the U.S. got out in front and started talking about Darfur. It completely turned off the rest of the world from engaging in the issue.
Where do you think the Darfur activists in the States got it wrong and perhaps made things worse?
I think we, and I have to include myself in the start of this, were over-reliant on the analysis that we had been given of what had gone wrong in Rwanda, the genocide there in 1994. People who did the lessons learned writing from that came out with the conclusion that what was missing was an outcry from the American people. And it was a very, you know, post-Cold War analysis. If the American people just raise hell, then the U.S. government will do something and then this situation can be resolved. That was not the geopolitical reality at the start of the 21st century.
So today, trouble still in Darfur, in the north, in Egypt, crisis, secession likely in the south of Sudan. That must build up a lot of pressure on President al-Bashir, and there's still that arrest warrant for the president. Where does this leave him? What's he going to do now?
At the moment, he's being promised an awful lot by the U.S. government to let Southern secession continue. And, you know, the U.S. government is going to have to deliver on those promises. But that cannot wipe the slate clean for the ongoing human rights abuses in the North. And I think it's going to be a very tricky line for the U.S. government to walk how to balance those things.
Rebecca Hamilton, author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Thanks for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you.
Check out our in-depth coverage of Sudan, including some amazing photos at theworld.org. Now, for our geo quiz, we're talking Packers and Steelers, but also Gladiators and Wolves. Sunday's NFL Super Bowl is fast approaching. The Green Bay Packers and Pittsburgh Steelers will kick off their title game early Sunday evening. That's around midnight if you're in the central European country we're looking for today. It's home to plenty of NFL fans, and you can bet they'll be staying up late to see the game. Some of the most passionate fans are the country's 2,000 football players. That includes many women who compete on amateur football teams.
Some of the teams include Debrecen Gladiators, Nyíregyháza Tigers, Donak Soldiers, and Budapest Wolves.
Budapest Wolves, that's a pretty good clue. We'll tackle a linebacker for the answer in a few minutes. In 1987, at the height of the Cold War, President Ronald Reagan famously gave this speech at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
2 years later, the Berlin Wall came down and German unification ultimately followed. But in Berlin today, there are few signs of Reagan's historic statement or the man himself. This Sunday marks the 100th anniversary of Reagan's birth, and as Susan Stone reports, some in Berlin say it's time the city pays tribute to the great communicator.
Berlin has streets named after prominent Americans like Benjamin Franklin, John Foster Dulles, and Frank Zappa. John F. Kennedy alone has a plaza, an institute, and a school to his name, not to mention a private museum at the Brandenburg Gate. The gate is not just a historical spot, but a major tourist attraction, says Thomas Rimming of Berlin Tourist Information.
Brandenburg Gate is a highlight in Berlin. It is a symbol for the war, for the history, and everybody likes to see the Brandenburg Gate. It's like Eiffel Tower in Paris.
There are signs detailing historic events related to the site, though there is no reference to Ronald Reagan here. Some people think there should be. But Berlin Senate spokesman Günter Kolodczy says there's simply no room.
Das ist sehr geschichtsträchtig und deswegen ist es da eng.
It's a historically significant place, and therefore space is very tight. We have passed the information on to Berlin's districts in the hopes that they can find an appropriate street to name after Mr. Reagan, but we haven't had an answer yet.
He points out that Ronald Reagan was made an honorary citizen in 1992, along with Mikhail Gorbachev, the highest honor the city can bestow.
Berlin, natürlich, Mr. Reagan ehrt.
Of course, Berlin reveres Mr. Reagan and has a friendly connection with him. I believe that Berlin has recognized Mr. Reagan and that his spirit remains present in the city.
It's not just a question of space. There's a policy in place in the area to name streets after women to make up for the gender imbalance. And there's the cost of changing maps and street signs.
These are simple excuses. The real background is that there is a pretty left-wing Senate.
Parliamentarian Martin Lindner is a member of the free market pro-business FDP. He has been campaigning in vain for several years to have a street named after Ronald Reagan. He blames political infighting and lukewarm feelings about Reagan and the former East for holding things up.
I have learned in politics, naming streets is one of the most, it's a very emotional thing you can do. And I knew what I did when I tried to move it ahead in 2004.
After Reagan died in 2004, Lindner proposed changing the name of the area near the city's new train station. It was named after George Washington in 1932.
When the people come by train to Berlin, they would arrive at the Ronald Reagan place. A good idea.
But the idea never took hold. Instead, one of the only places you find the "tear down this wall" line, along with the small photo taken during the speech, is in one of Berlin's newest subway stations. Those passing through the station on this day have mixed feelings about naming something in the city after the former U.S. president. Gabriela Fetzke, who was born in 1945, says for her, street names don't tell the whole story.
Whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, okay, fine. But with 20 years of hindsight, when we see how everything turned out, maybe those in charge weren't as clever as we always thought they were.
Her younger friend, Stephanie Prose, is more concerned that a ceremonial street naming would be an empty gesture.
When we name places after well-known political figures who have done something for Berlin, you need to explain something on a sign or a plaque. Explain why we should care.
A piece of the Berlin Wall, decorated with a graffiti butterfly, holds a special place at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California, and may be a focal point of this weekend's centennial celebration. But in Berlin itself, no movement on the issue of commemorating Ronald Reagan is expected until after the next local election in September. For The World, I'm Susan Stone in Berlin.
Coming up, let me hear your balalaikas ringing out on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For our GeoQuiz today, we're looking for a Central European country that's got a thing for football, American-style football. Veronica Guias wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about the growing popularity of football there. This is a country where more than 2,000 players, including women, compete in amateur football leagues. And many of those players are planning to stay up past midnight to watch the Super Bowl from the U.S. on Sunday. So, what country are we talking about?
This country is Hungary.
So where do fans gather to watch the Super Bowl in central Budapest?
One of the favorite pubs is Legend in Petőfi tér, for example, by the River Danube. Or there's another one, Champs Sports Pub in Dohány Street, which is in the Jewish district of Budapest. These are all really fancy places. We don't always watch games in pubs, of course, because that would be too much of an expense, but the Super Bowl deserves treatment.
The Super Bowl deserves a big flat-screen TV. But Hungary, former satellite of the anti-American Soviet Empire, how'd this enthusiasm for U.S. football grow so fast?
With the appearance of NFL on TV, there's a widening audience for the sport. It counts as very special, nice or exciting to watch, and it counts as a sort of babe magnet as well among young boys.
You said babe magnet?
A babe magnet, yeah. So it's cool with girls if somebody plays American football in Hungary.
We need to underscore your own enthusiasm for U.S. football. You play.
Not in Hungary, though, because we are the only girls' team in Hungary. We play in the Austrian Girls League.
What position?
I play linebacker.
Wow. How do the Hungarian women stack up against the Austrian women?
Last year, we were second comers.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yes.
And do you play other countries in Europe?
This year we're planning a Barcelona visit, a friendly match. But so far, as part of the Austrian League, we only play the Austrian girls, yes.
Now, of course, a complicated part about watching the Super Bowl in Budapest is the time difference. The kickoff time there is going to be after midnight. The halftime show will be during the early morning hours. Everybody who's watching it going to be at work on Monday?
Some of us will be, yes, including myself. my very lovely boss has already said that I could sleep in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are many who take the day off.
Veronica, I have to end by asking you, who are you rooting for on Sunday, the Packers or the Steelers?
Packers.
All right.
Because my favorite coach is a huge Packers fan.
And the best food for watching the Super Bowl in Hungary, is it chicken wings or goulash?
Chicken wings.
Wow, I thought you were going to say goulash.
Sorry about that. We tried to go for the American.
Veronica Guyash, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Oh, thanks a million.
Los Angeles is home to 500,000 immigrants from Russia. It's also home to an unusual orchestra that plays music from that part of the world. Beto Arcos paid the orchestra a visit.
One, two, one, two, one.
Irina Orlova runs a tight ship as director of the Los Angeles Balalaika Orchestra. At this rehearsal, she directs an ensemble of more than 30 musicians. Peter Rothe, a founding member of the orchestra, plays the balalaika. It's a triangular string instrument that's ubiquitous in Russian folk music.
One thing that is very special about the balalaika is the fact that two of the strings are tuned to the same pitch. It's plucked.
Play something. So how many balalaikas are in this orchestra?
If you include every triangular-shaped instrument, there are over 10. Three of the small balalaikas and then several medium-sized, which play sort of viola or a middle voice. And there's one that plays in the cello range and one that plays down in the double bass range. It's really a challenge to fit that one in most cars. If you play that instrument, you have to take it with you when you go to buy your car.
And though balalaika is clearly the star in this orchestra, there is another solo player, the domra. That's Irina Orlova's instrument.
That's a round body instrument like a mandolin. It's tuned like mandolin and like violin. And that's, in our orchestra, it carries the function of violin in symphony.
The orchestra's main focus is classical, Russian, and Ukrainian music, and the musicians range in experience and in age. Fiona Fetter is 14. She and her 11-year-old brother Tommy have been playing domra in the orchestra for more than 5 years.
I started out playing violin, and my dad wanted me to learn mandolin. She said it was the same thing, so so we started domra. We've been playing ever since.
The Balalaika Orchestra recently played a 15th anniversary concert at Schoenberg Hall on the campus of UCLA. The concert opened with a classic piece by the creator of the modern Balalaika Orchestra, Vasily Andreyev. But it also included Irving Berlin's Putting on the Ritz. Director Irina Orlova looks back to when she first took over the orchestra in 1995.
When I landed in Los Angeles 16 years ago, I did not have an expectation of an orchestra which we have today. And these children whom I'm teaching, they are showing me how much we can do all together. And I think it exceeded the expectation I had 16 years ago.
For the world, I'm Beto Arcos in Los Angeles.
You can see videos and photos of the talented young balalaika players and the orchestra at theworld.org. Eric Goldberg composed our theme music from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
PRI's The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio Boston. The World is supported in part by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. More information at nsf.gov. And by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming. PRI Program Fund contributors include the Ford Foundation and Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees.
PRI, Public Radio International.